Good morning, diners and travelers, and imbibers as well. I don't want to leave you out.
Oh, okay. We're not leaving the imbibers out.
No. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. Good morning.
You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today we're going to be looking at some of the tracks that we've been sitting on for a little bit, haven't we?
Well, there's a couple of oldies but goodies that never quite fit in, but we're going to fit them in today. But starting out with the program, if it has a theme, it has a theme that says what should you be eating, where should you be eating at, and where should you be traveling to.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's good to know.
Yeah, it's a theme. Well, it's sort of thematic. That's why I put them together.
But, oh, I see.
We're starting off with Leslie Anderson, who's a senior editor with
Chow.com.
One of the things we talked to her about was food trends, differences between 2009 and 1999, a decade earlier. But we covered quite a lot of other ground as well.
I thought it was 2000 and 2010.
Well, it's
10 years.
No, we did a comparison back to 1999, and then we did talk about what we thought were things that were hot for the next decade as well.
I think she also was explaining to us the structure of Chow. I mean, Chow Hound was, well,
she was. Yeah.
Let her explain it.
Yeah, she explained all that, so let's just go to the tape.
Leslie Anderson is a senior editor at Chow.com. And she's going to talk to us, first of all, about what Chow.com is, because it's actually had some evolution from its early days. And then also we're going to pick her brains about what we're going to expect as food trends comparing today to 10 years ago. Welcome to On the Menu, Leslie.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with you.
What a great idea to compare that. But tell us, first of all, what Chow.com is. I had bits and pieces of information, and not all of them accurate. So how about telling our listeners what it is and what it isn't?
Well, Anne, Chow.com is an online food magazine. It's basically a destination for people that love food and want to learn how to be better cooks. We have original recipes that we develop in our test kitchen. We have videos that show you how to make things and how to improve your cooking technique. We have articles and a blog about trends in the restaurant world and in the food world. And then we have message boards where people can post, you know, hot tips about where to go to get the best donut or, you know, should I go to dinner tonight. So it's really kind of, it's a lot of different things, and it's a great place to hang out and sort of see what's up with the food world.
And do you observe people doing that? Are they chowing all day long?
We do have quite a few visitors. I think people really enjoy going to their local board, which, you know, you can go directly to like the Washington D.C. board or the San Francisco Bay Area board and kind of see what's going on. Like, I mean, I was just checking out today where the best places in San Francisco are to get holiday baked goods. I mean, that was something I hadn't even considered because I usually make my own, and it made me kind of excited to try some of the goodies that are out there.
And what is there? What kinds did you come up with?
Well, there was an interesting sounding bakery in Berkeley that makes a bûche de Noël, and that is absolutely not something I would ever make for myself, those little mushrooms and things.
Oh, yeah.
Leslie, just to clarify, how did that content get there? Did you put it there, or did a visitor to the site put it there?
A visitor to the site put it there. Okay. All of our restaurant reviews are created by users that come to the site. And then what folks like me do, I do actual kind of reported stories about trends in the food world. So we have a little bit of both. We have some expert stuff, and then we have a lot of just good on-the-ground information from community people.
Okay, so you've got your own editorial, but then you've got a Chow community.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right.
And the Chow community is called Chow Hound.
And Chow Hound started out as being a really edgy restaurant search and comment piece, right?
I mean, exactly. Chow Hound was a very early website. It began in the mid-90s. It was started as a way for people to exchange information about restaurants. I remember I was planning a trip to New Orleans, and I used it extensively to get good tips about where to go.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, Chow was starting as a magazine, or a little later. It was starting as a print magazine. Chow and Chow Hound were purchased, and the company that bought us morphed us both together into one website. So
it was sort of like two halves of the coin. So
at
one time you were separate, and then you became joined.
That's right.
And then you became changed anyway.
Well, we sort of operate under the same tent, but we do different things.
Yeah. Now, it's subscription only, isn't it?
I know it's open to anyone, and it's to totally free to use. You can, if you want to post a comment, you have to be a registered user, but it's totally free to join.
Oh, okay. Well, it used to be, didn't they used to charge?
Not to my knowledge.
Chowhound? No, I thought they did.
Anyhow, to my knowledge.
But the reason we're actually talking today, of course, we're at that magical moment, the end of a decade.
It's really the fake decade.
Yeah, well, I mean, he doesn't even believe in the millennium.
Well, this decade didn't start when it started. It's a year off, and how they can say that the decade of the Audis ends in 2009, I have no idea. But let's not argue over that one. Everybody is seeming to think that a decade is rolling, so I guess we'll roll with it, right, Leslie?
Yeah. In any case, 10 years have passed.
Okay, and so you were telling us, you're comparing the difference between food trends 10 years ago and the trends that we look forward to now.
That's correct, yes. We, you know, at the end of the year, we always look back on what went before, and we decided to look back on, wow, what were things like in 99 compared to we're closing out 2009 at the moment. And it was really funny, you know, we started cracking ourselves up thinking about it because I don't know where you guys were in your heads in 1999, but I was out here in the San Francisco Bay Area where it was dot-com mania.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, money was just flowing like a river, and people had expense accounts like young kids. There were parties every night. And the things that were being consumed at those parties and propped up in the restaurant world as being the cool thing to eat and drink are so different than what are being consumed now.
Can you give us some examples, Leslie? We can think back to 1999 and we traveled the world at various different parts of the world at that time. I can't think that we were in California very often. So what you saw in the Bay Area is probably not true to what we saw in the East, and certainly not what we saw in our home city of Pittsburgh. So,
mm-hmm. Well, what was popular in at least New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, where I was spending the majority of my time, was sushi, and really any kind of Asian-inspired fish dish was all the rage. Seared tuna, towering piles of tuna topped with sesame seeds, any kind of sushi, any kind of prawn, oyster. I think fish kind of signaled to people money, and it made a real impression when it was out on the table.
And in 1999, this was still fairly new.
Sushi seemed very luxe to people. It seemed fancy. Now, of course, what do you want to go out to eat tonight? Oh, sushi. But back then, it still had a novel, luxurious feel to it.
Not only that, but we also have this whole new ocean preservation consciousness now.
So it's
not cool to eat bluefin tuna.
It is not cool. So flash forward to 2009, where just about every fish that everybody loves, from prawns to salmon to tuna, it has some kind of massive problem with the fishing industry.
Yeah.
And bluefin tuna is a total no-no. The World Wildlife Fund is predicting that it could be completely extinct in the Atlantic by 2012.
Yeah.
No more bluefin tuna. And the culprit is sushi and sashimi.
But it's the Japanese that's really doing it. I mean, I don't know how we're going to stop that. That worries me, too.
Very worrisome, yeah. And then we've got, you know, the blue crab season melted down in the Chesapeake Bay in 2008. We had a lot of problems with the salmon fishing industry. So go from fish and sushi being all the rage to 10 years later, people are like, what kind of fish can I eat anymore? The answer is, well, not a whole lot.
Right.
Better stick to California rolls. Lots
exactly.
of avocado and other things.
Rice.
Avocado, yes, and cucumber.
Okay, so what next then? So we have this, sushi is not the big thing that used to be. And what do you think is the hot new thing that replaces it?
What replaces sushi? Well, I think these days people are very excited about things that you know exactly where they came from. The more local, the better. And, you know, local has been a buzzword for a long, long time, but we're seeing it taken to really kind of incredible extremes now where people are actually producing their own food or foraging their own food.
Yeah. They're also doing their own beverages. I mean, we just interviewed somebody about craft beers, and that's part of that whole movement, too. And when we were in Portland, Oregon, there were all the local distilleries, which is a new development. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. The closer you can get your food to home, the cooler it is. I just did a piece on these people in Brooklyn that are actually raising bees on their rooftop.
And they're all over the place.
Yeah, they're doing their own honey, even though technically it's illegal to have beehives in Manhattan and the five boroughs.
It is illegal, huh?
It's still illegal. Yeah, it's illegal. It was made illegal during Giuliani, and it still is illegal, but people are producing their own honey.
Anyway. Yeah, it's not the only illegal thing that's going on in New York City, let's face it.
Everything, the White House has its own apiary, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does, yeah. So whereas in 1999, the hot things were imported things, exotic things, things from Asia. Now, it's like you're saying, Anne, it's people making their own beer or buying beer from the brewery that is right in town. It's very, the hot thing now is to get like mason jars or big bottles called growlers and actually go fill up at the local brewery and bring your beer home like that. It's like something out of the, you know, revolutionary times era.
Now, at its most extreme, I guess you would say, you would have a restaurant like Manresa in Los Gatos, which as a restaurant is serving as much as it can from its own farm.
That's exactly right, yeah. I mean, I think
isn't it wonderful too?
Yeah, chefs take a lot of pride these days in being able to grow all of their own or as much of their own produce as they can. In fact, I spoke to the owner, chef owner, Aris Kokanon, of this restaurant in Denver called the Black Cat. And he not only grew his produce, you know, his summer produce for his menu, but he built an entire root cellar for himself. And now he's, you know, using all the parsnips and the turnips and the potatoes from that during the winter.
Yeah. Look at Blue Hill. I mean, they even do their own animals. And then, of course, the next thing is the butchering. Everybody's doing butchering now, too.
Right. I think people are seeking a greater connection with their food, and they want to feel like, you know, they're doing something to be in touch with, you know, the planet and where their food is coming from. And so the more they can get involved with that, from growing their own little garden to maybe getting to know a local butcher to, there are people that have clubs now where they buy entire sides of beef and split it up amongst ourselves. Oh, did you do that?
We did. I got a fifth of a pig.
And then
I got, what was the other one? The cow was so bad.
We got some portions of the cow. The best parts were the ground beef and the beef tongue.
Yeah.
Which was out of this world.
It was grass-fed beef, but it was not very good.
In fact, we have a beef tongue in the freezer right now. It's not something you can get every day. Now, what about what people are people drinking different things, Leslie?
Absolutely, yeah. Back in the dot-com days, the big thing was vodka. I think it was a little bit going along with people's obsession with high technology, because there really is no more high-tech drink than vodka, if you think about it. It's basically a spirit where every single bit of flavor or aroma has been stripped out through process.
And then it's been added back, I guess.
Right, in some cases added back. So people were really into vodka. It was vodka in martini glasses and fruity, you know, kind of candy-colored drinks, appletinis, cosmos. Nowadays, people are going back to these old-fashioned speakeasy drinks that are like three ingredients, oftentimes made with brown liquor, kind of old man drinks.
So you're talking about Manhattans and Sazeracs and things like that.
Exactly.
I don't know that we should call them old men drinks.
Since I happen
to like these things, and I don't like to give away my age, but I certainly was drinking a long time before vodka was a popular thing to drink, except in the Soviet Union.
Mm. Oh, right.
Now, what about wine? Has there been a change in people's wine tastes as well? I mean, California, if anywhere, California would show such a trend, since so much American wine comes from there.
Yes. Well, the thing with wine is people are still drinking wine, but what you're seeing these days are a lot more lower cost options of wine for people because, hey, you know, we're in the middle of a pretty serious economic recession, and people can't afford to buy these pricey California wines with the gusto that they once were able to. And so you're seeing actually good box wines or better boxed wines. You're seeing wines in jugs that are pretty good. And then you're also seeing restaurants that are offering things like waiving the corkage fee a week or offering half off on bottles. And these are nice restaurants. Every day I see some new deal that involves, you know, some cut on wine, and I'm kind of flabbergasted because, as we all know, that's where restaurants make their money.
Now, on the beer side of it, you would probably agree with me that it's sort of more of the same. What was already happening in 1999 was an interest in microbrews and less interest in Budweiser, and what we've now got is an more extreme version of the same thing. Would you say?
I would agree with that, but what I would say is that because of a few notable individuals in the brewing industry, we have just an explosion of really creative beers that are out there right now. I don't know if you've ever heard of the brewery called Dogfish Head.
Yeah, we were just talking about that.
Yeah, we had Sam, the owner, mm-hmm. on the program together with Marnie Old, who's a wine and beer educator.
Oh, okay.
They wrote a book together called He Said Beer and She Said Wine. They were very good together. And Sam is just absolutely terrific. And
Sam is a very charismatic, creative guy who has done more for the brewing industry than anyone, I think, probably that I can think of ever.
You think so? In the last decade he's been really in the lead?
Oh, God, yes, because the thing about him is not only is he making these really experimental beers, you know, beers based on samples of beer that were found in, you know, old Egyptian tombs, or beers based on old Mayan recipes. I mean, they're really far out. Not only is he doing that, but he has a way of telling the story so that people really understand it. And he's been able to take the beers out of the realm of just beer geeks, you know, geeky guys, into the realm of, you know, all kinds of people who are into them, like, you know, young women who used to only drink wine now are drinking beer. There's all these new beer restaurants opening up. It's exploded in the past 2 years, I'd say.
Now, has there been a change in people's water habits? I mean, in 1999, had bottled water throttled people's attention, or did that happen just during this decade?
Bottled water was really big in 1999. I remember going to my parents' house and giving them this big lecture about how they needed to get one of those Alhambra water dispensers because nobody drank tap water anymore. And wow, have things changed. Now we realize that, particularly in the case of the individual plastic bottles, that drinking bottled water is just incredibly wasteful and bad for the environment, and that we need to really rethink our prior assumption that tap water is, there's something wrong with it, because, hey, you know, we live in a first world country where our tap water is pretty darn safe.
Yeah, I just read something to the contrary, but that's all right.
Yeah, I guess it depends where you live, huh?
Well, no, I mean, it was a national study.
It's all a whole lot better than water in the third world, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Now, what of all the stuff that you've been reading about trying to coordinate the difference in this decade, what was the most astonishing thing that you found as a difference between then and now?
I think the most astonishing, that's an interesting word. I mean, certainly we could point to the explosion in organic food. You know, now you can get organics at Walmart and Safeway's making its own organic brand, whereas back there, really, you know, if you wanted to get organic food, it was Whole Foods if you were lucky enough to have one, or the little local health food store or farmer's market. But I think the thing for me that is the most astonishing, and maybe this is just because it's kind of a fun fashion thing, but I just think about the way that restaurants looked and just the whole feel of going into a restaurant in 99 versus 09.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, so in 99 you had like these real sterile environments. People were coming in with their sort of space age looking shoes, and everything was like very sterile, very fancy. And nowadays, you go into a restaurant and it's picnic tables, big communal tables where you sit down and rustic
napkins. Yeah, look
napkins.
At David Chang and his empire.
Very casual.
Well, okay, well, I tell
but
you
there's
what.
Not one really strange thing that we haven't noticed as a trend that we should be picking up on.
What's that?
I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's something I'm missing.
We would just speculate. Here's what we'll have to do. We'll just have to invite Leslie. You're invited back 10 years from now for the second fake decade of the...
Don't tell me I have to do this for another 10 years.
Of the fake millennium. And
we'll
see what's happened then. We won't be unfair. Unfair it would be to say, Leslie, what do you think is the most interesting that's going to happen in the next 10 years? And then in 10 years' time, we'd hold you to it. But we won't do that, because if people need to find out those kinds of things, they can always get on www.chow.com and ask you themselves.
All right. I was going to make an astounding prediction. But
go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. If you want to be
right.
brave enough to do that, go ahead.
All right. I'm going to predict that 10 years from now, we are going to have a vegetarian president of the United States.
Okay.
Well, we're probably fairly close now, but never mind. That's a story for another day.
Yeah, I mean, we've redefined the whole vegetarian lifestyle anyhow, I think.
That's true.
So, I mean, I wouldn't be astounded by that. But anyhow, you're a delight, Leslie, and thank you so much for sharing your insights and research with us.
Thank you so much. It was really fun talking to you both.
Oh, and you too. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Our next guest, actually, is going to be a U.S. travel editor, Robert Reed, of Lonely Planet. And I can't resist this tie-in. You'll have to forgive me, Rabbit. I want to say that we don't want to be lonely, so please communicate with us.
Oh, that's very clever. Oh, yes, that's very clever. So,
well, we usually do that at this time, reminding people to email or tweet.
Well, just click on the social network or email link of your choice right on the homepage of our website, and we'll always, of course, look forward to hearing from you. And now let's go back to Lonely Planet, which has more places for you to go than you would ever get to. But recommendations as to how to make the choices, you know, where are the hot places, where are the really interesting places.
The best in travel for 2010, plus 1,000 ultimate experiences. Millions and millions of people rely on the Lonely Planet travel guides. And we have with us today the U.S. travel editor, huge job, Robert Reed. Welcome to On the Menu, Robert.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
Now, we originally contacted you because Lonely Planet released recently two books. One is 1,000 Ultimate Experiences, and the other one is Best in Travel 2010. Which do you think we should start with?
Well, I think, you know, either works. They're books that are kind of fun to make because you get to forecast the way things may be going in 2010, or kind of have something that's aspirational for people on different types of trips they can take in general. Like, that's what the 1,000 Ultimate Experiences is. We could start with 2010 if you like.
Sure, that sounds
good. Okay, that's
good. So these are front burner things you should be thinking about in the year about to start.
Yeah, it is fun to make. I mean, the 2010 book, which I contributed some, but there was many authors that contributed to this, because there's about 250 to 300 authors that work for Lonely Planet, and everyone kind of pulls in to get their idea of what's going to happen in 2010. So you have to rope in all the different opinions that everyone has and put it together. And you come up with a list of the countries, the top 10 countries to look out for, the top 10 regions to look out for, and then various themes. Like places to go cycling, you know, biking is on an uprise now, value destinations, things like that. And so it is it isn't just like you don't say top 10 countries, the top 10 countries that are going to be visited in terms of numbers, because it's often the same top 10. France will always be right there at the top. But you talk about, and that's a great country to go to, obviously. But we talk a little bit, like, for one is maybe a lot of people haven't heard about is Suriname. And this is a country that is kind of a little bit on the rise, and it's in the northern part of South Africa. And we hear about what's happening with the Amazon and Brazil and deforestation, and some of the Amazon is being threatened. But the rainforest in Suriname, they've done a very good job in this small little country of preserving it. And so there's a lot of ways still to go. They haven't used any deforestation, and they work on kind of ecotourism. And there's a string of eco lodges on the river you can go to by boat. And so it's kind of interesting, and I think that it's going to get more and more popular as people want to find new things to see.
Now, as I looked at your top 10 countries, a couple of them seem to raise a question mark in my mind.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, I haven't been there. All I do is read about what's going on, listen to the news. One is Nepal, where I thought there was sort of quite a lot of uprising stuff going on.
Well, yeah.
And another one was Bosnia, which would have been certainly close to the bottom of my list at one time.
You know,
the photograph was peculiar even.
It's that part of Eastern Europe, you know, through the Balkans, is really, it is growing out of the conflict that we remember from seeing. I've updated the books for Bulgaria and Romania on several occasions. And a lot of people, you see more and more travelers that are crossing through, going through Croatia and crossing Bosnia, going into out of curiosity. And, of course, the locals are excited about it. I'm not saying all the problems are over there, but you can visit there. And increasingly people are going overland through that region to see what it's like. And
well, do you actually list areas where you have to watch out?
Well, I mean, that's always a part of this. You know, I worked on the Colombia guide last year, and Colombia is a country that has had some difficulties in the last 15 years or so, obviously.
Mildly.
Yeah, that's nicely put. You're very tactful.
But the thing is in the last 5 years, things have gotten a lot safer there. And it's not to say all the problems are gone, but now Colombians themselves are enjoying their country. They're using the buses and going on the highways because there's no longer guerrillas having roadblocks and stopping buses to get money or even kidnap people. That's gone. And so the country has changed. Now, and the reason why I bring it up is that's reflected in the book itself, because when it was particularly dangerous, the book went from 500 pages to 200 pages to just focus on the places that were safe to go to with the proper warnings of the places that you really probably should avoid.
Now,
the book is getting bigger again because it reflects what's happening there. You know?
If it's not in there, then, I mean, that doesn't mean you shouldn't go there, but possibly you left it out because maybe it's not so safe or it's just not, you don't think it is nice anymore.
I think that there is a responsibility of saying, here's a region that you may hear about locally, right? And this is what's happened. These are some facts. This is what's happened there. And we advise going against it, and we didn't send an author there because of the risks involved. And a good example of that is Iraq. And we have a chapter of Iraq in our Middle East book. Much of Iraq is a war zone, and it's not a place to go and try to travel.
You know, but that's funny. The travel detective or whatever it is, he recommended Iraq.
Well, the thing is that there's different parts. But the northern part in Kurdistan is actually a rising destination. There is an increase of people going there, and it is considered locally, they call it the other Iraq, because it's a place that is almost lives as its own country. There's a different currency, a different government, and it's like you go in overland from Turkey, and people are going there. In fact, GIs on break are going there for their vacation time, essentially, and it's not, it hasn't been dangerous. It is a different situation. So even within a place like that, there are places that people go to, and people need to know everything about it. You know, I mean, obviously you have to think very carefully before going to a place like that. But even
Iraq
is a place you can visit.
What is your demographic? Who do you write these books for? Who reads them and uses them?
It is a global company. It's based in Australia. It's you know, the leading publisher, a travel guidebook publisher in London, so it does very well in the UK and also the US. And it's kind of changed over the years. Started in the 70s, and it was mostly about people going on backpacking trips.
Yeah,
that's when
I first encountered it, yeah.
But a lot of these people have grown up with it, though, and so it's changing and reflecting that. We have a whole new series on regions around Europe, like Provence and Tuscany, things like that.
Yeah.
People are getting rental cars and summer villas and things like that. So it's
now,
very little wider than...
Robert, I lived in London. But nevertheless, you know, we didn't go for a long period of time, and then we go back together once a year. And early on, I bought the Lonely Planet Guide, and I have to say, it was very good. The accommodations were tended to be more budget-minded than we were, but in terms of where to go and how much it costs to go there and those kinds of things that a traveler or a tourist might want, I thought the Lonely Planet Guide did an extremely good job.
Well, it's good to hear. I mean, I did go to Lonely Planet. I can say, I mean, I work for the company now, but I did go to it as a fan. You know, I mean, I used it a lot beforehand. And something that's changed, and particularly in the last 5 years, is reflecting this interest that a lot of people want to stay in nicer places. And that is happening in the books now. There's an increase in mid-range and even high-end accommodations.
Well, the founders were young, right? There wasn't a single founder. No.
Yeah.
I remember reading an early one where one of the writers was actually complaining about the food, but then said, well, unfortunately, she was pregnant at the time and was having trouble with her stomach.
Oh, yes. That's funny.
That she was Australian, I believe.
Well, the founders are Tony and Maureen Wheeler. They're married, and Maureen's from Northern Ireland, and Tony's from England. And they moved, they did a trip across Asia in the 73 and finished in Australia and set up the company in Australia. And that's when they started making guidebooks after their long trip across Asia.
Wonderful.
Now, we've got the two books side by side, the 2010 Best in Travel and then the 1000 Ultimate Destinations. How would you suggest that people use these books when they're thinking about where to go? Let's suppose that I'm trying to decide where to go in February because the country we're going to go to, it looks like the arrangements aren't working out.
Peru by the way.
So now I'm looking for somewhere else to go. In this case, preferably south of the equator because it's warmer there at that time of the year. How would you sit down, how would you recommend people sit down with these books and use them to plan out an adventure?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different ways. It's kind of the dream book, right? I mean, some people like to look lists and to create travel lists that they want to see the Great Wall, they want to go to Red Square, they need to see Eiffel Tower, they need to see a Mayan pyramid, whatever it may be. And some people actually create lists. I don't because I'm not that organized, but some people do, and some people use a book like 1000 Ultimate Experiences because it's kind of timeless. It talks about these icons and these adventures that you can get in different places that are absolute classics. And by the way, there's no limit to the amount of ultimate experiences someone can have. It's not limited to 1,000. These are just 1,000 of them.
Oh, sure. And so you're saying map your ideas against the 1,000 rather than the other way around. Don't try to start with number one and go to 1,000 and try to pick which one's best.
I think this is a book that you kind of refer to. It's divided in 100 top 10 lists that are thematic. Some of it is like the best street food, or the best markets, or the strangest museums, or you know, the friendliest countries. So it's broken down in things like that that's more kind of often like a did-you-know factor that will kind of go in and kind of get the dreaming to begin. And the 2010 book, in a way, is a little bit more targeted to next year. I mean, if you have February open, I mean, there's a couple things that are going to be very prevalent next year. And there's two big events that are happening, the Olympics in Vancouver, and the World Cup in South Africa. Now, you may not want to go to British Columbia in February if you're not interested in outdoor sports in the winter and things like that. But that's going to cause a lot of people to think about that. And South Africa is a good time to go in February, actually, being down there. And I think that what you're going to see after the World Cup and during the World Cup, obviously, is a huge bump of interest. Maybe going there beforehand would be interesting. I guess the third thing is Hanoi in February, the Vietnamese New Year, turns 1,000 years old. And they've been celebrations for that for years now. And it's actually a wonderful, wonderful city. It's absolutely gorgeous. A lot of people who haven't been may have a different impression of what the Vietnamese capital is like, but it's a very walkable city. You have these little lanes that are named for the guild, that these ancient guilds, like a tin maker's street, and all the tin makers are on it, or Chicken Feet Street, because that's where you go to get chicken feet.
Like you like that a lot, huh?
Yeah, I had the pleasure of living in Vietnam in the 90s. I was in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City. But Hanoi is really, I think, it's my favorite Asian city. It's very attractive and very evocative and very, just a great place to be and kind of walk around, get the Vietnamese iced coffee because it is sometimes hot. And it's wonderful. Poets in Vietnam and the painters in Vietnam, they're from Hanoi. You know, it's kind of the cultural base of the country's culture.
Yeah, you had some really well picked out places like southwestern Western Australia, where we enjoyed about 9 days almost 2 years ago, and just a wonderfully God-given spot on the planet. You mentioned Hanoi. So let's test you out here and say, suppose you had three more places out of each of the books that you would want to focus people's attention on. What would they be?
We mentioned Suriname earlier, so I'm going to cheat and do that one. I think this is an interesting place. It's extremely diverse. The capital, Paramaribo, there's like six languages going on there. It's very, very diverse, and everyone gets along. It has a very good reputation of having limited to no tension whatsoever, and they do a very good job of preserving their rainforest. So I think that's an interesting country that, you know, everyone wants to find something new, and it's easier to get to places than it used to be. I think Suriname is going to be an interesting.
Now, this is on what continent again?
That's on the northern. It's one of the small little countries north of Brazil, at the northern.
Okay,
part
I thought
of
so.
South
I,
America.
I thought you said Africa earlier.
I thought
on.
You did say Africa.
I'm sorry. I may have spoke too quickly. South America.
Oh, okay, because I was wondering how I missed it in Africa.
I should disclose something to you that I might have disclosed before we came on the air, because my education is in geography. I have a master's in geography. And I thought, boy, he moved Suriname to another continent, but I guess continental drift might still be going on. Well, give us one more. So we got Suriname, and we like Hanoi.
Are you talking about for you for February or in general?
No, just in general.
You know what I think is going to change? And this, I think Europe's a little ahead of us in the United States on it, but I think Iceland's going to boom a little bit, because Iceland right now is cheaper than it has been because of the economic situation there. And there's going to be some new flights that connect Iceland relatively cheaply. Now, it's kind of, not exactly, but, you know, almost midway between Europe and the United States. And so I think if you're talking about people in North America, more and more are going to go, even for 3 or 4 day trips, because from the east coast of the U.S., it's about as close as going to San Francisco. And so I think that Iceland's going to really rise, and it's better value than it has been, and it's going to be cheaper and easier to get to.
I'm just not particularly interested in it. I've never found anything fascinating about it.
You don't like things related to snow, and you're probably not all that keen on hot springs either. So let's switch over to the ultimate guide. So you've got three top places that you think people must go to before they die. We actually got a book entitled 1001 Places You Have to See Before You Die.
Yeah.
I'm sure that I liked it nearly as well as your book, by the way. But two or three out of there, and then tell us why.
Well, a lot of it is the stress of experience. It's not necessarily going to see the Great Wall. The Great Wall definitely makes it in here, and it's a wonderful place that lives up to its expectations. But it's more about like how you interact, whether it's eating food or whether meeting people or doing something in the place. So that the stress here is a little bit on the experience, kind of get a little bit under the surface in local communities. And it's hard to even know where to begin. I really like, you know, a lot of people go to Bangkok and they go to the floating market. You know, and I'm always interested in going to markets, but other market, the Chatuchak, which is like 200,000 people go a day, and you get even a better sense of how the local community works. And the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul is another classic market with like 400,000 people go a day. And I went there for the first time a few years ago, and it felt to me like my first trip. Like, wow, I remember what it was first like to going to a very new exotic place, and I just remember that again despite how many miles I'd done. The third thing I would throw in is the Trans-Siberian Railway is not overrated. It is a wonderful experience. It was started in 1891. It connects Moscow with Vladivostok, which is seven time zones. I mean, it's hard to even grasp how big Russia is, how long it takes 7 days on the train to cross it. Now, in the Soviet Union days, you had to get fancy permits. In fact, you couldn't even get to Vladivostok because it was a closed city, because it's the home to the Navy there. The Soviet Navy was based there. And now you can easily. But now you can kind of hop on and off as you like. You can stop in Yekaterinburg, where the Tsar and his family were killed right at the beginning of the Soviet Union. And there's some exhibits there to see. You see Lake Baikal, the largest freshwater lake in the world, which is absolutely fascinating. It looks like an ocean. It's like over a mile deep, rimmed by mountains, and it's just wonderful any time of year. They have festivals in winter, and summer you can take boats out to islands and go hiking. So the Trans-Siberian is really one of those experiences that it also gives you access to the Russians, because you'll be kind of sharing carriages with the Russians, your cabin, and they can be wonderful. They'll shame you with their kindness. They'll treat you like family and gave you whole tomatoes to eat from the, that they grew in their own garden and things like that. Sometimes a little vodka too, but it's a great,
like
great
that,
experience.
Yeah. I guess you're going to be writing about the Richard Branson's spaceship pretty soon. Huh?
That's right.
He's sending his 91-year-old father on it.
Well, that's a really lonely planet if you get off it, right?
That's right. I guess I will have to save that for the ultimate experiences off the planet. At some point.
Well, now, where are you going next, Robert?
For the holiday season, I'm sticking around New York City, you know, where I live, and I actually will be doing a trip I'm looking forward to in a couple months across the Great Plains of the United States, which is one of my favorite places to go because it is the epitome of the flyover zone. You know, Kansas, Nebraska, the flat plains.
So what road will you take? Will you take I-70 or will you take US 40? Or?
I want to go up and down, straight through it. You know, those interstates are the way that most people cross that area, and they're leveled off. You know, you get on those two-lane roads, and you get to see things like the so-called car hinge in Alliance, Nebraska, where they made a model of Stonehenge with cars. Or
there are some really funny places, I know, and of course, we used to live in Kansas City, Indianapolis, Ann Arbor.
I remember the Kansas Turnpike. They had to put a sign up to say you were now entering the Flint Hills, just so you would know, notice there were hills. Well,
that's
Robert,
right.
Well, that's great. Let's see,
1,000 ultimate experiences and the best in travel 2010. Listeners,
are they on our website?
Listeners,
yes. Yeah, they're already
truly,
on our website.
Truly invaluable guides if you can't figure out where to go and you need 1,000 ideas. And good luck trying to figure out which place you like best if you can only
so
choose
many
one or two.
Places, though.
You can enjoy anywhere you are. That's the beauty of travel. It can be around the block. You know, it doesn't stop and start and stop. It's always there. The experiences.
Well, we will be in New York City at least two or three times this year. So like you, we love the Big Apple. And after a few days, we have to go home and rest. Whereas since you live there all the time, you're fine with it. And the most amazing thing about it, and we'll just conclude with this thought, I think. I can remember back to New York City before 9/11 2001. I can remember being there shortly after 9/11 2001 and how empty it was. And it's absolutely amazing to see how it's once again become what surely must be the world's most populated as far as tourists are concerned, because if you're around Times Square, the last language you'll likely hear is English.
Right.
It's an international city.
It certainly is.
So we thank you for your contribution to the world of travel thought and travel ideas, and keep up the good work at Lonely Planet.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, Robert, it was good meeting you.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, well, those are some interesting places I wouldn't have given a thought to, but... Oh, we have to get working here, Robin.
We do. Yeah, we're just going to have to be on the road even more. And of course, you'll be on the road more, too. And who knows? Perhaps we'll come across one another. Perhaps we won't. There are enough places for us all to choose from. I'm sure we'll never get to all of them. So just as we suggested in the interview, you're going to have to prioritize, and the books will be tremendously valuable to you in trying to figure out where to start.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back. We're back and we're doing some spring cleaning or autumn cleaning or whatever kind of cleaning you like. A couple of interesting tracks that somehow didn't seem to have any sort of neighbors. We saved them and knowing that you'd be interested in them, and they fit into a couple of very interesting categories. We're going to
explain Simpsons to me.
Explain Simpsons. Well, Simpsons is a restaurant with rooms.
Yeah, I know that, but how does it fit
in England? It's sort of like a destination.
Uh-huh.
At least that's what I thought, because we've been there three times at different times of the year with different people cooking in the kitchen. It's just been a whole lot of fun every time we went there, and this particular year, was last November, it happened to be Peter's birthday.
We had
a wonderful birthday lunch there, and then we hied ourselves back towards Heathrow Airport because we were on our way home. But it's a stop that you should make. You can stay there. They have six very elegant rooms.
big rooms.
And they set a wonderfully mean table, and you'll be sure to have a good time, whatever season you go. This time of the year, the outdoor area is closed. The last time we were there in the summertime, we ate on the patio. It's just a wonderful place that Chef Andres Anton has put together. It's on the map. Should you have the misfortune, Birmingham not being one of my favorite cities, to be there, this will make it worth the journey. You can be sure.
It's been almost 5 years since On the Menu came to a restaurant with rooms in Edgbaston, outside of Birmingham, called Simpsons. And we just we came back another time because we were passing through and had a wonderful time with another chef, Adam Bennett, Luke Tipping, the executive chef, and Andreas Anton, the chef owner, isn't here today. They're off because it's Monday, but we came specially. There's a reason. I don't know if they told you that. It's actually co-host Peter's birthday today. So although we have to rush back to Heathrow Airport to return our rental car and go home, we just couldn't resist stopping by and saying hello. And today we're talking to Matt Cheel, who's on duty today as the chef. Matt, welcome to On the Menu. Give us an update on anything about Simpsons that you think has changed in the last few years.
Oh, yeah. Well, not a lot's changed. We've still got the Michelin star and trying to improve on that all the time. The restaurant's going from strength to strength. We're very busy, which is always a good thing. We recently won 26th in the country, best restaurant. I forget the name of the book now, but I'll find that out for you, which is a brilliant accolade for us. We're just rocking along.
I remember this from talking to Andreas. We asked him what his ambition was, and he came right out and he said, 3 Michelin stars is what I want for my restaurant. He said, I'm a Greek Englishman, but that's what I want for my restaurant. And the standards have certainly kept up, and we've heard about Simpsons from lots and lots of other places too. Are there any special new dishes on the menu that perhaps we might be having today?
Yeah, we've got a few interesting dishes at the minute. We're using foie gras with banana at the minute, which is quite an interesting combination. Also with it's also got panda peas, spiced bread on the dish, which is a real interesting mixture of flavours that work really well together, which is quite interesting. We're using a lot of succulent pig at the minute. We buy from France, which is a lovely piece of meat. We've got some interesting fish dishes. We use monkfish with Indian spices. Also sea bass with figs and vanilla salt, which is another nice dish.
Now, it's perhaps a little bit unfair to ask a chef at a restaurant that's competing in the market in Birmingham for attention and for guests, but I did announce ahead of time to Matt that I would ask him if he could mention 2 or 3 other places in Birmingham that perhaps you can go if Simpsons is too busy. Over to you, Matt.
At the minute, the food in Birmingham is brilliant. You know, it's coming along really well. We had 2 restaurants gain Michelin stars last year in Birmingham, one being Purnell's. I actually worked with Glyn Purnell because he worked at Simpsons when we were in Kenilworth before. So we worked together for about 5 years. He went to work for Claude Bozzi, and then he opened his own restaurant called Jessica's. That gained a Michelin star. He then moved properties and changed the name to Purnell's, and he recently got a Michelin star, which is brilliant for Birmingham, and it is a fantastic little restaurant, really nice, clever chef. And also, sorry.
There's also Indian, I think, is popular in Birmingham, and there are some pretty good places in that market too, right?
There's a place that I used a little bit further out of Birmingham called Tamarind, which is a brilliant Indian restaurant, but there's Indian restaurants all around Birmingham, and also Chinese. You know, we've got a very large Chinese quarter, some really interesting, restaurants from all around the world in Birmingham, which is brilliant for us. One other place that I forget to mention is Turner's Restaurant in Harborne. That's just gained a Michelin star. It's a very nice little restaurant, an interesting restaurant, good one to visit if you're here.
Well, it's better than Birmingham used to be. I think when I came to Birmingham as a very young man, fish and chips was probably the best you could get. But this is England's largest city and continuing to grow, so the demand is certainly there. And you've been capitalizing on it, and it's nice to know there are choices of other places to go as well. Matt, we better let you go back into the kitchen because the restaurant's about to open. But any last thought you'd like to give us other than greetings from Luke and Adam and Andreas?
Not really. Just it's lovely to have you back here again, and I hope you enjoy your lunch.
I'm sure we will. Does co-host Anne have anything to say before we close up?
I'm hungry as always.
Oh, okay. So let's get down to us because Heathrow Airport is facing us a few hours from now, so we'd better be on our way. Matt, thank you so much for talking to us and on the menu, and we're looking forward to lunch.
And now we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, here we are again. And we're concluding the program with, shall we call it a bang? Pretty much. You could certainly call it a bang. There are two events on the Pittsburgh calendar which are really fascinating for imbibers.
Right.
Who are fans of On the Menu Radio. One's the Pittsburgh Wine Festival, which is in the springtime. And then in the fall, for the third year this year, there was a wonderful event called the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival. And in honor of the Whiskey Festival, guess what we did? We gathered a group of whiskey specialists, and we asked them to talk about their products and different kinds of whiskey. And there were six people and three microphones, and it was really quite a zoo.
It was fun, yeah.
Somehow or other, we think we managed to get a good interview out of it.
Do we have a photo on the web?
We have a photo. I don't think I put it on. I don't think I put it on the website yet.
Okay.
But we can certainly do that.
Yeah, I don't know if it was particularly.
I think you probably didn't like the photo. That's probably why it's not
there.
That's
probably it. Okay.
Anyway, let's get a little bit of a primer on whiskey. On the Menu is surrounded by whiskey people, which seems like a good position to be in. And we have no less than six of them at the Pittsburgh Wine Festival. And I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves. First of all, a star mixologist, Bobby G. Gleason. Go ahead, Bobby.
I'm Bobby Gleason. I'm with Beam Global Spirits and Wine and the master mixologist.
And I'm Simon Brooking. I'm the master ambassador for Laphroaig and Ardmore, single malt scotches. My mission is to spread world peace through whiskey one dram at a time.
Well, can I just say, by the way, Laphroaig is my most favorite brand of scotch.
I'm John Bickersmith with Maker's Mark Distillery.
Hello, I'm Dan Tullio with the Canadian Club Whiskey Company, and we've been manufacturing, blending, distilling the Canadian Club at the very same location for the last 151 years. Glad to be here.
Hi there, I'm Tish Harkis, manager of Canadian Club, and walk, talk, eat, sleep, breathe the brand, the whiskey, Canadian Club.
Okay, and last but not least.
And I'm Bernie Lovers with Jim Beam, and I'm a whiskey professor, and I represent the small batch bourbon collection of Knob Creek, Basil Hayden, Booker's, and Baker's.
With all products ambassadored very ably by Fred Ngo. And I was reporting earlier that I made a mistake and said I talked to Booker, but we actually did talk to Booker while he was still on this planet Earth, yeah. and what a wonderful fellow he is.
Yes. Well, he's always and with Fred. Us. He's always with us in spirit.
That's absolutely, right. no question about that. And everybody's here for the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival, and being surrounded by all these wonderful people, I thought it'd be a good idea for them to explain what their whiskey is versus the other whiskeys. So start with Scotch, which probably claims to be the oldest of the whiskeys. Go ahead and tell us, how did Scotch get started, and what today do you think makes it distinctive?
Well, certainly the
You've
the
got Scots. 2 minutes, Simon.
I tend to be very long-winded.
But well, you know, if you're long-winded, I'll cut you off. I haven't had a drink yet.
600 years perfecting it. I mean, we take a long time, so we tend to... Things happen a little slower in Scotland, and we like that. We have a Laphroaig 10-year, we have a new Laphroaig 18-year. 18 years, you know, 18 years in the barrel, and we don't touch it. We put it in for what we call the long sleep. Single malt Scotch, Laphroaig and Ardmore. Ardmore is a fully peated Highland whiskey. So for our table here tonight at the festival, it's all about for Pete's sake. We've got two very smoky, peaty-style whiskeys, and that comes from drying the barley over the peat fires.
Well, it's for Pete's sake for another reason, too, and we're going to sample some. Now, let's move on across the big pond to Maker's Mark, which I mentioned earlier, and I'll say it again so that John doesn't have to say it. Absolutely the best popularly priced bourbon on the planet. How do you do that?
Well, our mash bill is a little bit different than most of the other bourbons. Bill Samuel's father substituted red winter wheat for rye, because most bourbons are corn, rye, barley, and Maker's is 70% corn, 16% red winter wheat, and 14% barley. So it's the red winter wheat that gives the taste profile that Maker's has.
And a splendid taste profile it is. Now, Canadian Club has been on the market for how long, young man?
Canadian Club has been around since 1858. This year we celebrate our 151st birthday.
What do you think about that? What do you think about that, Tish?
Well, again, you know, this brand, God bless, it's distributed to 151 countries around the world. Whatever corner of the globe that you're in, you're going to find good old CC. It's around everywhere.
Now, Canadian Club is different as a whiskey because, apart from anything else, of the major ingredient. Am I correct?
Well, to be called a Canadian whiskey, we have to be made from a variety of different cereal grains. For Canadian Club, for the various marks within our brands, we use corn, rye malt, and barley malt. Corn is the least expensive of the grains, but we produce a neutral grain spirit. With rye malt, and barley malt, those are the grains that we refer to as the grains that produce the blenders. Also, to be called a Canadian whiskey, we have to be aged for a minimum of 3 years. We feel that 3 years is not long enough. The youngest brand within our fold is Canadian Club, which is 6 years old. 36 months just doesn't cut it. Then we have a 10-year-old format, as well as a 12, 20, and 30-year-old.
So we're going to have a busy night. Now, rye whiskey is making something of a comeback. I think there are some new products on the market in the rye space. Has that been good for Canadian Club?
Yes, it's been very good. All of the portfolio, all of the brands in the portfolio, they're pre-barrel blended, which is one of the characteristics of why the whiskey is so smooth. So what's happening is the chefs, the mixologists, Bobby G over here, they're really switching up a lot of these, what used to be the old vodka, the Cosmos, with Canadian Club. And you think about a CC Caesar, and Caesar, it's always made with vodka. Well, now they're switching it up and they're putting Canadian Club in there. So very versatile product.
Well, that's a great name. Now, last but by no means least, the largest portfolio, I think we can probably say, of single-barrel bourbons. And the concept of single-barrel came from who?
Well, that came from Elmer T. Lee when he came out with Blanton's in 1984. But what Booker perfected and actually invented another category was small-batch bourbons, and that's what our collection is all about. Booker said to Elmer T., that's great, but a barrel will taste different resting side by side. It will age differently because of the way the temperatures work. So his idea was to take a small batch. We have continuous stills. So we don't make them in small batches. It's at the end where you take 200 or 300 barrels of your best places in the rack house, and then you mingle those together for a small batch. So it's kind of misleading, kind of like a oxymoron, if you will, kind of like a Peacekeeper missile or good vodka. But
it's a funny thing. When we conversed with Booker,
yes,
when he did a whiskey tasting in Pittsburgh in 1984, I think, mm-hmm, and somebody asked him about single barrel bourbon. He said, I've been tasting single barrel bourbon practically my whole life.
Sure.
Because I taste a barrel at a time.
That's right. That's right.
He also talked about the Angel Share. Now, the Angel Share is something I think you all experience. Perhaps we can have our mixologist friend explain the Angel Share.
Well, now today at Beam, we call it Booker Share. Fred, he swears that the share has gone up recently in the last 5 years.
So Booker's
up there enjoying his share with his friends. But what we use, when we're using these different blends and different whiskeys, that my role is to create new cocktails with them. And tonight we'll be showing people how to make the great classics we're going to be doing.
Before we conclude then and get on with the serious business of the evening, I'm going to go around the room. I'll go the opposite way this time, starting off with Knob Creek. What's your favorite cocktail using Knob Creek or any one of the other things in your folio?
Well, I'm a pretty simple guy. I'm a bourbon neat, bourbon on the rocks kind of guy. But when I make a cocktail, I like something to be refreshing. A lot of people will equate bourbon, and I know there's several people who will not drink bourbon in the summertime. And I don't understand that because there's ice in my glass when I have my bourbon. But I like an old one it's a Presbyterian, and it's very simple to make. It's with bourbon, with like a Knob Creek, and I also like the Old Granddad 100 proof. I like 100 proof bourbon. That's my common denominator. And then put half ginger ale, half soda water. It's very easy to have. Ginger ale actually brings out some of the natural flavors from the barrel. Okay. Also, ginger ale has sugar in it, so you don't want to mask too much of the flavor from the bourbon, so that soda water cuts down that sugar and lets you enjoy the flavor of that bourbon.
And it's called an Old Presbyterian.
It's called a Presbyterian. I understand, because a Presbyterian could drink it, and it looked like they were just drinking ginger ale because
like,
the way that worked.
I love it. Okay, Canadian Club.
Canadian Club. Well, again, going back to what I had just said a couple minutes ago, I love the classic Cosmo. We make it with 12-year-old Canadian Club whiskey. And I know it's just something that people almost, you know, they hold their breath when I say that, but it truly is. It's so refreshing and light and very dangerous, by the way.
Yeah.
They go down way too easy.
I think we may skip that one, I think.
whatever happened to the CC and Coke?
It's still around.
Oh,
CC and ginger is very popular still.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Now, since you brought a colleague, just a quick one.
The way I enjoy Canadian Club is in Manhattan style. We have a signature drink called the Millionaire's Manhattan. Basically, you grab an elegant lowball glass, jam it up with clean ice that's been in a freezer less than 24 hours, a measure and a half of Canadian Club Classic 12-year-old, and then a half a measure of Harvey's Bristol Cream Sherry.
Wow.
Instead of using sweet vermouth, it's sherry, Harvey's Bristol Cream. Garnish it with a couple of maraschino cherries. And then on the top of the glass, get a rind of orange and just go, just like that. Just get a little twist so that the oils fall out on the glass.
That sounds fabulous.
My mouth is just watering right now. I can't wait until my friend Bobby G makes us one of these tonight.
John?
Well, actually, the Manhattan for us is the biggest drink across the country for Maker's Mark, except we use Mrs. Samuel's recipe, and instead of using bitters, we use additional cherry juice with the cherry. So it's a little bit different off the typical classic Manhattan.
Now, it may be heresy to mix Ardmore or Laphroaig in a cocktail, but...
Absolutely not. We're seeing across the country now with all of the mixologists, U.S. Bartenders Guild, it's very exciting cocktails that are coming out using Ardmore and Laphroaig. So we encourage folks. They're great flavors. They're much more of a challenge, Laphroaig being such a big, robust-style whiskey with that smoke, but it offers a whole other layer to the whiskies. We were talking before
what do we put with it?
But I take it back to basics. For me, splash of water, you know, certainly with Laphroaig being so big, add a touch of water, like dew on a rose, it opens up the bouquet. And just a splash or rocks as well. Some folks say, what do you think about ice? Well, I don't need ice in my, you know, in Scotland it's cold and damp and rainy, we want to warm ourselves up. So
that's when I really got to appreciate Laphroaig, when I realized how cold and damp and rainy Scotland was. What is the plaid on your kilt?
This is a Robertson. I'm from the Robertson clan.
Great.
Yes.
Well, last up is our friend who's the expert mixologist. So what's your favorite?
Well, you know, I think people should go out and enjoy all the spirits and find what they like. And the best cocktail is the one that you have in your hand. And, you know, what I'd like to say is drink what you like and like what you're drinking. But know what you're drinking.
Well, that sounds to me like an absolutely splendid idea, because we're on the menus working here. We don't have a cocktail in our hand yet, because there's a demilitarized zone between where we are and all the liquor. So we're going to correct that very quickly. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
And have a great evening. And we did have a great evening. And if you have a mind to drink a little whiskey, you might think about going next year. It's usually in November, and we'll have an announcement of it on the website.
Lots of dates go there.
Date. Is it a good date thing?
I don't know. I guess so.
Anyway.
People get all dressed up.
Anyway, it seems like an appropriate way to finish out a program, so we hope you enjoyed it. And
Toast to that.
And, of course, we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.